The Team Never Quit podcast is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. Partner with Navy Federal Credit Union to pay down credit card debt. Learn more at NavyFederal.org.
Al-Qaeda had been seriously weakened from all of our attacks against them over the years. We called it mowing the grass. Remember, Mark? He's like, just keep killing them off. Eventually, there's, you know, not going to be anybody left. And it worked.
Never quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Team Never Quit podcast. We are very excited for the show. Today, we have on Chris Miller. Before we dive into Chris and his story, let's kick this off with our Patreon question of the day. What is the most ridiculous thing someone has tricked you into doing or believing?
I can start off on this one.
Most ridiculous thing that someone or you has tricked me into doing annually is diving into the coldest water annually every single year at Christmas, before Christmas.
Oh, it makes you tough. You don't have fun doing that.
Yeah, every single year. Christmas Eve, we have to dive into the nearest lake or body of water when it is just freezing outside.
That's a new year. It's called the cleanse. Cleanse our souls.
The polar plunge.
The polar plunge, yeah.
And yeah.
It's a thing. It's actually cold. Man, we're on record though. Last year was the coldest in the history of Earth. And we were actually in the water, just me and you. So congratulations. How about you?
Oh man, Marcus. That's a really good one. Most ridiculous thing. I was going to come up with something pithy, like my wife talking me into marrying her, but she would get really, really upset with that because I was the one who tricked her, you know? So it's kind of the obvious.
Yeah, but did we trick them or did we get tricked by tricking them? It's the women. You can't figure that out.
That was my one, man. I was like, doggone, man. That's a great question, you know? And then I had this one every April Fool's. My kids are like 21, 27, 28 right now. And I've been doing this ever since Bill Belichick started coaching and winning. And I will send, like, I will do a dummy post about how Bill Belichick is, you know, resigning or moving to the Bengals or something.
Right.
And every year, you know, my one daughter will take the lead and she'll get, oh my gosh. And then my son, of course, like, Dad, because he's connected, right? He's getting live feeds on everything. Bill Belichick literally can walk outside and get in his car. And my son will like, hey, Bill Belichick just went to this car. So he's like,
oh, yeah. So, okay, check.
For me, man, oh, that's a good one. That's a good question. So that's
that is a good question.
What do you got, Marcus?
I've had a lot of time to think about it. I have to say cooking, like recipes. Like we do a crawfish bowl here every year. And the way I learned how to cook crawfish, they were like, this is the only way you do it. This is the best. You do it like this. You put the water in there and do it. And then I think it was a few years back, right before quarantine, this kid rolled in on me. He had to be 18, 19 years old. And I don't remember why we hired him to cook the crawfish and I wasn't doing it. But for whatever reason, my brother was there. My whole crew, we were sitting there watching this kid. I think it might have been Easter or something. And of course, we're all over there surrounding. We're like, hey, this is how you need to do this. He's like, no, I got a different way. Just trust me. He's like, I understand the way you've been doing it. It works. It does. But I just got this way. I like to do it. Just let me show it to you. Don't trust me. Don't do any of that. Just let me show it to you. And man, we were talking smack because I come from a family full of Cajuns, man. They'll literally kill you if that stuff didn't. That's like, you can't even come back, hang out if you don't get this right. Man. Am I lying, Hunter?
No, you're not wrong. It's got to be spicy.
It's got to be good.
Extra spicy.
So we get back, and sure enough, man, he cooks them and delivers the batch over, and it was the best. It was better than we were doing it. Not only that, when I went back to one of the Cajun family reunions, I got put in charge of cooking, and they were like, hey, this better be good. And I did it the new way that kid showed me. And they were like, that's awesome. You cooking the whole time. And I was like, okay. And I even tried to do it the new way, and they would come over and scream. He's like, no, you got to do it this way. I'm like, trust me. Or don't trust me. Just let me freaking do it. Just let me do this for you, and I'll just show you. So I think that is how, when you're young, it gets put into you. This is, it's not necessarily good, bad, or indifferent. It's just the way, right?
Yeah.
That's a funny one. That's a great question. I could think all day on that one. I'll have to come back. To
you. I bet you Hunter's got one. I guarantee you.
Well, mine was the polar plunge.
The polar plunge.
He's having to do that since he was a boy. I'm on video, man. I can't see anybody moving their lips. Who's sitting next to you?
John.
We got John right here.
Oh, John's not allowed to speak?
He's
I
mute.
Just hadn't answered yet. But I am
mute. Oh, okay. I got you, Hunter.
Say something.
Dude, hello. I'm sitting in a doggone Holiday Inn Express in Knightsville, Florida. You guys didn't invite me to come out there to text. No, I'm just kidding. I knew you would bring me on, but sorry, I couldn't do that. So I'm sorry. I didn't see you moving your lips. That Hunter was the polar plunge. Got it.
Yes, yeah. Go ahead, John.
Mine, I remember one time, like when I was just starting to play guitar, this guy had me come join him to play his set, and I realized halfway through he was getting paid to have me play his show. I was like, very clever, sir. Very clever.
That's called mentoring.
Yeah, that's what that is.
I can't remember, was Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer. It was one of those books that we had to read growing up, right, that you're supposed to read in like probably junior high, where didn't Tom Sawyer get Huck Finn to paint the fence or whatever? Or maybe like I had it backwards. But so he kind of pulled that on you?
Yep, exactly.
Mr. Miyagi too, right?
That's right, man. I was going to say, some of that stuff's lessons. Deck, paint the fence, it's the best way to learn lessons.
Hunter went there, Mr. Miyagi. He's got the depth of
you can't believe it.
Marcus, I've been training this freaking.
This you know, I grew hey, up with. He put me on to old classics. I mean, growing up.
From the minute I walked into the house, I have a hunter and an axe, and both of them are sharp. And if I send him a hunter, you know, he's deadly. He's Miyagi trained, and he's got a little bit of Cobra Kai in him. He's me too. I didn't hold back on either.
Marcus,
I'll let life shave him out.
I'd like to come down and visit you down there and just see your I'm sure you got the compound where you got like,
I do.
You can go out and do all shoot there guns, is. Do some hand to hand.
It's just got, like you would think. Kids, that's why they call it Valhalla. Yeah, man. Yeah, I live in Valhalla. If y'all are wondering, it's a real place and that has everything he just said and more.
Give you a brief background that we have. Today we have a great guest for you guys. Chris Miller is a retired United States Army Special Forces Colonel who served as Acting United States Secretary of Defense. He previously served as Director of the National Counterterrorism Center as well. He is also a retired U.S. Army officer and began his military career as an enlisted infantryman in the Army Reserve. He transferred to the Special Forces and served in numerous command and staff positions within the 5th Special Forces Group, Airborne. Chris participated in the initial combat operations in Afghanistan in 2001 and Iraq in 2003. In addition to numerous follow-on deployments to both theaters and his extensive interagency and joint special operations experience. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey, I'm absolutely honored. Marcus, first book event, I'm just saying, so thanks for having me. I couldn't imagine, like, you know, a more meaningful rollout. I guess this is the book launch officially, you know, in some ways, but I don't want to talk about the book. I want to, you know, thank you for what you've done since you left.
Yeah, no, we're going to talk about it. And that's the difference. I remember back when I started doing this, you couldn't get books online. That's not how it worked. And I remember when that was coming on, all the authors were like, ah, oh, it's going to ruin everything. I was like, nah, it's going to be a transition. And now you get to do a book tour, not only on the road, but virtually, which is great.
Yeah.
I loved being on the road, doing that, going into, someone told me one time, I was like, you can't ever be in a bad mood in a bookstore. And that's true. Like you walk into like a big, like a Barnes & Noble, and the way that just everything that's in there, it's a good time. I had a blast on those book tours.
What was that like when you saw your book on the shelf for the first time?
No one's ever asked me that.
It must have been like, dog.
This must be the first time I ever thought about it. humbling.
Yeah.
You got to understand, I was still in the military. I had the military mindset, so it was more like orders. And this guy, no one's ever asked me that.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, it's because, good. Well, no, it makes me think about it.
Because publishers, like, they were like the best selling.
It was unbelievable.
Come out of our war is your book. I was like, that's a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was to be chosen to carry that one was as a something.
It's a heavy burden, yeah, but it's also such an honor to be able to tell all the guys' stories and keep their memory alive. I mean, as long as that, I mean, it's not about the book selling, it's about the story being told and repeated over and over. And as long as that carries on, those guys will always live on. So,
well, the way I figure that if it wound up on TNT or on Memorial Day and Veterans Day,
yeah,
then we did well.
The movie, yeah.
Yeah. And then how I know it got solidified is I've run across an individual a couple that named their son after one of my teammates.
Yeah.
From all of them. Yeah. All of them have been renamed.
Yeah.
In triplicate, some of them.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, you can make the movies and the books, those can burn, and then you can't see that, but that was when we got it done.
That must have been surrealistic for you guys to have that impact. And I know, you know, you end up going, well, this is the direction, you know, our faith has taken us. But that must have just been like to have such an impact. Dude, you don't remember, I was on that, you went out to the basic training brigade in South Carolina with our good friend, Kent Solheim, who was part of the
Captain
operation.
America.
Come yeah. up there.
How about that freaking guy?
And
how about
you know,
that dude?
Well, yeah, Kent.
I mean,
Kent
come on.
Kent, come on, don't give Kent any credit. You know what?
I'm not going to anymore.
Well,
that
Marcus,
freaking guy,
gotta work harder.
Yeah, I know. I don't even... What a terrible, awesome, terrible.
I know. Kent, dude, you know, I mean, he's got like, you know,
perfect teeth. You know, his breath smells like NyQuil all the time, probably, or some kind of something from Bed Bath. His hair is always perfectly combed. Even when we were on that freaking mountain, after days, he would take his hat, helmet, and freaking hair would just be perfect. He had that like a Mentos smile. Dude, missing a leg, still runs faster than me.
He's like a G.I. Joe.
He is. That's him, man. Like, oh, yeah. That's him. Or yeah. Captain America. What's yeah. everyone freaking
And then Kent, you know, he's the quintessential Green Beret, man. Oh, he is like the poster boy. And then, you know, Kent, when he's not like working full time as an Army colonel and pushing troops and like really training the next generation, mentoring. That was why it was so cool to see you at that thing. Because that was the first time I'd ever, you know, I ran across you back there coming on 20 years ago, but of course didn't know you. When we went up there, went up that damn mountain, which was epic, you know, dude, it was, I know you were a hell of a lot hotter and a lot more hurt than we were, but I just remember how hot it was that day. I remember the sun comes up and the sun, dude, I didn't know the sun could come up so early. I don't know whether it was where we were in the world or something, but it was like 5 o'clock.
Right? That must be some kind of dent in the earth where we were at because it would freeze or be hot as hell. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What was up with that? And the sun comes up, and dude, it was like, I'm not kidding you. It was like 85 Fahrenheit in the morning. I was like, this is gonna be a day. But you know, so Kent was there, and then you know, Kent now is mentoring, and he brought you in for that professional development for the kids. Well, you can't call them kids, the young soldiers, to hear you, and he had the cadre, and to hear you. And your ability to talk to them and meet them where they were and to tell them your story. I mean, I was just in awe. I just like, and then they'd be like, does anybody else have anything to say? And I'm like, I'm not saying anything, you know? And then the one guy, the intel guy that was on there, he'd say something. You're like, typical intel guy, right? You're like,
they have
dude.
To. That's they can't.
He had
can't
to say them. Something. I was they like, just let to. Marcus go.
They have to say something.
Just let Marcus go. And he would come up with, well, then the Bot 15 raid on the QR-56 that we had flying
aren't they
overhead.
Great?
But yeah. The way you communicate, and then Kent, we'll close out with Kent. Like, so when he's not like either doing PT, mentoring people, he's got that nonprofit where he's helping out veterans. You're like, yeah. I do not like Kent at
Loser.
All because he's the person
nobody
that I
likes that
be.
Dude.
And he's just like still giving back. While he's on active duty, and he'll probably get in trouble for us talking about it. He'll have his general come in there like, Kent, we heard you on Marcus Luttrell's show. And,
we're going to need you to.
So we don't care because Kent's the best, man. I'm glad you still keep up with him. That was a real, it was a super meaningful event for us.
That's the first time I'd ever had ever happened.
That was, the first nervous. Reunion.
When we were all together for the first time. Just because, I mean, every angle was covered down on there, and it was something to hear. Because we just started talking.
Yeah.
We hadn't all talked about that.
Probably should have been done a long time ago, but timing is...
The war's never ended. They were still fighting. All the guys are still deploying.
Well, I didn't know, the two Rangers there were awesome, you know?
Oh, those freaking guys.
I obviously went up the hill with them, or they flew in that night, or the next night.
How about that hodgepodge we had? It was great.
And the intel guy, frankly, was great too. I was making fun of him, but I never knew all that stuff.
Yeah.
I was like, huh? Which, Marcus, we got, I don't know if we're supposed to talk shop on your show.
It's okay.
But the fact that, they had all this exquisite intelligence and all that. You know how much got down to the ground for us? This much.
Dude, we were joking about it. We joked about that a lot.
Sorry, I didn't mean to frequency hop on you. Whatever.
No, that's great.
About other stuff.
But you got to have some kind of ability to freaking make fun of them for something. They can't be perfect. You don't be an asshole.
Well, it's so interesting now, all these years later, to have all of these different people put all the puzzle pieces together, because it was such a shit show when it was going on, obviously. But now, and there was a lot of emotion after that, and a lot of guys had a really hard time after that. But now that all of these years have gone by, it's like y'all can all talk about it now without getting angry.
The only reason it turned into a shit show is because everyone was in there. And it was pure guerrilla, kind of all the tech and everything. And so as we've had time to reflect on it, when I talk to people, they'll come up and say, man, I was doing this, but I had this problem, and this is why. I was like, well, it wasn't a problem, actually. What was going down was this unit was coming in and blocked that with this, that, and the other. It had nothing to do. And they were like, really? I'm like, yeah. I was like, you got to understand, everybody was in there.
Yeah.
And it makes them feel better when they hear that, because it went down and then it disappeared.
Yeah, a lot of people think that certain things are their fault. Well, we were on our way and got turned around. We should have been able to go. And it's nobody's fault. It was just a complete shit show.
I talk about this in a chapter in the book, and that I described it exactly as you just did. I said it was a shit show. And what you said, something really powerful, two things, if I could be so bold as to comment, if you want me to be quiet, just do this, stop talking, Chris. One is I still am learning stuff. And like you said, you'll be out at VFW, or you'll be at an event, and somebody will start talking, and I will learn something every time. Somebody else had a role that I had no, and the story's never been told. I got to tell you, man, I don't know if you want to go there. But I really think that it's a story that needs to, we need to bring everybody together.
Oh.
And that's why I like what Kent was doing.
How would we even, that would be great. Mm-hmm. That would be so much fun. That would be a mini series that would last forever, dude. You can't even.
Because it's a lessons learned, and you're all about passing it on. That's what we're all about now. Yeah. And you're not old. I'm old. It's all about passing on. Hey, and the young kids won't care. We were talking about your sons and your family, the young kids, and mine are the same way. They never listened to me, but we got to do it. When you were out there at South Carolina at Fort Jackson, about three kids came out of there with a different view that's going to help them down the line. And you were really good about that. And number two, so I'm not putting any pressure on anybody, but I just think the story, what you said, the story has not completely been told. People still have pieces of it. And then the second point, it's so true about what you said about how we're older now and the emotion. It's so fun to see. Well, I have a problem because I call everybody out. We'll be at an alumni event or we'll be at a association event. And these two dudes that literally hated each other in 2001, that literally were going to kill each other because they hated each other so badly, are now best friends, and they're all weepy and hugging each other. And I call them out. I'm like, whoa, 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 stop right there.
All right.
Stop right there.
You know what I had to deal with you two?
No, seriously. But it is so true that now I had, oh my gosh, we had this boss. He was remember Band of Brothers with the company commander? It was the
Sobel,
guy who played
good
Prince,
Lord, man. We were watching that last night.
David Schwimmer?
Yeah, Sobel. Kevin Sobel's who he played on. Yeah. we were watching that last night.
Were you really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's timeless. So remember,
it is.
When they got done at the end of the war, they were talking And they go like, hey, do you think we would ever have been this tight as a fighting force if we in a team, if we didn't have the captain being such an absolute a-hole to us? And it was the same thing. We had an experience like that before we went into Afghanistan in 2001. And we had a commander that was really, really tough. I mean, he was really tough. And we carried, I'm telling you, man, we carried that with us for 20 years. I never did this, but he was the man who can remain, will remain nameless, like some sort of, that's out of that Harry Potter series, yeah. Right? They were like, and I ran into this guy last year at an event, and I was like, we got to put that behind us, you know? I just went up and gave him a hug.
That's awesome.
Well, because you're talking about two different worlds. It's like turn around, yeah. Looking back at an avatar you got to run around in. It's just,
yeah. You know what I was thinking about while y'all are talking, and I don't know why I've never thought about this before, but in this war, I mean, this is one of the biggest operations gone wrong. I mean, obviously it is probably the biggest operation gone wrong. There needs to be like a patch or something that all of y'all get. Everybody that was involved.
Oh, it's a great idea.
To almost, you know, like the in Vietnam, there was all different kinds of just memorable missions or whatever that happened. And you know, somebody can say, I was part of that. And you know what that was. Why not have something like that for Red Wing?
Yeah. I could always tell when I run into somebody because the way they respond, that they kind of sit back, they always take a breath and they do their head like this. Like,
whoa. Yeah. Oh, right. Dude, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. This is the first time I've been able to talk to you about it.
Well, I love it when I run into everyone because we talk about different angles.
You play a role as I know it's got to be a heavy burden for you to bear and you and your family to bear, but I think you carry it lightly and you realize that this is the path that the Lord's put you on. And you accept that, but it's got to be really surrealistic for you guys to be literally, you are the face of the war, because there are a few other legendary figures that came out of that, but so much of it was a special operations war where there, and a lot of these guys are still serving, you know?
Yeah. That's the thing.
I just, man, I don't know how you
do it. How about
that? Yeah.
There's the freaking guys are still in.
Yeah, there's so many guys that we can't talk about.
With that Band of Brothers, my brother and I watched that exact scene last night, and we said that exact same thing, because when I watched that as a kid, I was like, dude, that guy is a dick. I mean, he's freaking mean. Ugh. And I had instructors like that.
Sure.
And then watching it last night, my brother and I were like, how about that dude? I was like, that's the guy that made him that tough. How badass. He's actually a great leader.
Yeah.
They were only with him for a few weeks, but hell was longer. So who's... And he never gets any credit for that. I ran across on a golf course one time, my instructor Getka. I mean, I was a SEAL for a while. I thought I was a badass. And I was literally on a freaking golf course, bro. And he's like, Latrell. And he said, I almost pissed myself when he said my name. I'll never forget his voice just because he was really good at yelling at me. Like his voice and where he came from in the country articulated my name well when he yelled and said it with some damn authority. And I'll never forget the hammers I had that pounded me into this, because I would have never made it through that.
He snapped you right back in.
Oh, man, just like that. And hey, that's what they're for. What do you care if they like you? They're young.
Yeah.
When it's like kids, like, man, I ain't your dada. I don't give a shit if you like me or not. I'm going to get you freaking right.
Yeah.
I got kids I got to love, you know, and I still treat them hard. So, they serve their purpose, man.
Isn't that the power of, I mean, that's the transformative power of our the way we do things in our military. I don't think it's that way all across the world. Like American, like, oh, we do things differently. We're special or something. But I really think in that regards, the way we train and mentor people that come into the military is different. Like I'm down here at 7th Special Forces Group. I retired in 2014. I was like, I don't know how special operators work. I'm down here with Green Berets. They let me walk along and see them on one of their exercises. I was like, I want to see how they do things now. You know, I wanted to see what new equipment they had, how they were integrating technology and all. I walked along, you know, and it's just like to hear the stories of kids. My thing is always, I'm like, hey, what'd you do wrong to end up in the Army? They start laughing. And every story is so transformative. You know, either it was go to Army, go to jail, flunked out of college, was literally sitting there going, my life is, I'm going to end up in jail if I don't get my stuff together. But that self-awareness.
We're all like that.
And then, yeah. And then to have like a structure that will take those people in and then form them differently, you know, and change how they view life in a good way. It's just so, and then you got that on the golf course where this guy, where your old instructor, and you just snap right back into like where you were.
Well, they're like, hey, you guys are the special kids. And I was like, oh, really? Have you seen what they do? They beat us every day. Do you do that to your special freaking kid? Matter of fact, when we weren't in combat, they would stick me underwater for 6 to 8 hours a day with a couple of my buddies. We must have been so damn special, or we're just freaking crazy. Either way,
or
we're
the ones- it was the world's greatest adventure.
Or it. Come to find out, it was the world's greatest adventure. It took me getting all the way to here to know that. She's the best at that. She'll say something to me like three words, just like that. The other day I was kind of getting uneasy about something. She's like, well, you might as well utilize it, take advantage of it. Instead of looking like it was trying to hit me, she's like, well, fight it, you know, work it. And I was like, oh, you know what I mean? It just takes a couple of words from either your spouse or your pal to turn it around. But when it comes to special forces, I always laughed about that. You just said it too. It's like, how special are you? You have to whip their ass every day.
Yeah.
I mean, all you give them is shiny things and toys.
But it's amazing how you can take kids, and not everybody that goes into the military is, you know, walking a line of you know, going to be in trouble or whatever.
Your SF dudes are.
But not all of them.
Bullshit.
Anyway.
But it I'm pretty sure 99.8%. Maybe 7%.
Okay. It is crazy that, like he said, you can take these guys and, like Play-Doh, mold them into just these awesome warriors that have not just the ability to fight for our country, but their honor and integrity and just their reason for living at that point changes. And that's so cool. And that's who they carry on to be for the rest of their lives. That goes into their marriage. That goes into just who they are as people.
My dad had a great line when I decided at 17, I was, you know, I needed a signature to join the reserve. And he said, Chris, you know, my dad wasn't all about like giving big speeches. He goes, the army makes a good man better and a bad man worse. And I'll tell you what, and I was like, rolled my eyes. Yeah, whatever. Stuck with me, obviously. What?
Amen.
That's a good one.
Later, that's a really good
one. That needs to be the damn motto. But what you said,
I was going to say, hey, Marcus, I want to try I got another thesis on special operators. They're all frustrated athletes.
Yeah. No,
They're all like, I should have made All-State high school, or I got screwed over by my coach.
Four touchdowns, you know, in a single game in high school.
They're trying to make up for not being, you know, first team or something.
How about that?
You think? Try that.
How about that? We have feedback. Two guys in our crew that I grew up with. We call them the athletes. And the trumpets, right? Because they had a band playing for them and everything. They got uniforms. And then you got the military. We just, it's almost like your bastard stepbrother or your cousin. Yeah, that's us. I try to point that out to people like, no, you guys are wonderful. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the wildest Mustang makes the best pony or best horse, right?
Yeah. So, right.
And the reason they say this thing's made of clay, because you can mold it. And like you take those, the sockets wrapped in completely. Don't worry about all that. But when they throw those guys like us in there, man, and when it comes back out with discipline, it's relatively the same thing. And I always thought, man, they throw us in our early 20s, and because we had war, we got stuck at that. Like, the reason you and I talk the way we do is because that's how we talked when we went in.
Never thought about that. And then that's exactly right.
Once manhood showed up and, like, kicked us in the face, we got stuck there. And then discipline started flowing in on that. When most people have an advantage to where they can cultivate that part, we didn't have that because another war kicked off. And then for every episode that we went through in that receive, reflect, respond kind of attitude – before we could go back and worry about it, another one came in there. Because we got
hit. Never thought
here.
About that.
Yeah, it's a fighter. You know, it's just like, man, my chief had to teach me this. He's like, you know what's happening to you, right? He would always tell me, he's like, I'm just sharpening you. I was like, life is sharp. This is what this is. He's like, you signed up for this. He would always remind me that. He's like, I thought you wanted to be a badass. I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, this
just
is
calling
what,
you out?
Yeah, all the time. Never slow down on me.
Gothro?
Yeah, man. He'll still call me
he
up.
This still dude does it.
This dude's the baddest sumbitch on the planet. Drives a Prius and smuggles cats from rescue shelters to their new owner. This is where they hide this dude. I mean, he's the baddest man on the planet of Earth. And I'm not kidding. This
he
is a real
really
dude.
Does. This guy.
It's hilarious.
Is like, if you see him, you would never know he was a special operator. I mean,
man, he hides it so, dude. Now
he is like, he looks like just the best dad. Like a dad. He just looks like a great dad that would just love you so much and never yell at you. But he was one of Marcus's chiefs. And
he's my sea dad. He's like always been my entire life. He caught me the minute I got there.
Yeah.
He spotted me. He's like, your ass is going with me. I'm like, Roger. He's like, I want you on the edge where the demons live. I'll pull you back when you had enough. That's the first thing he said to me. And I was like 23. I was like, yeah, let's do that.
What do you think he saw in you?
Man, those men, you could tell that they were like that when they were younger.
Okay, yeah.
And they can see that. You can recognize yourself. But even though it's in a different kind of wrapped in something different, just by the mannerisms. And he was with me. That sucker never left my side, man.
So I think when it comes, I mean, it's obviously we not talk about you too much. We'll talk about him. But
have we even talked about? I mean, what?
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Marcus's favorite subject.
Well, but I do, right? But I do think that in regards to Marcus, when he was younger, what I've heard his mentors say is that you could beat Marcus to death and he would always get back up for more. Like he wasn't the fastest or whatever, or the strongest, but he would not quit. He just always kept going. I mean, that's what everybody says about you.
Terminator core.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
So I think what they saw in him is that no matter what's going to go through with this guy, he's not going to stop. And we can train that into whatever they needed. They could mold him perfectly because he wasn't going to.
And a happy attitude.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, yeah. If you're going to. Once you realize that everything down here has been trained to hate me, kill me, come at me no matter what, then you kind of like, all right, well, I might as well have a pretty good, when you come at me with it, I'm like, that's a good one. Yeah, I mean, wow, that was good.
Right.
And then you switch it. So then it's just kind of, you see things for the way they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I call that like the rocket fuel. When you come to that level, when you have that realization, it's like it takes you to another level. I also think when you realize it's all about selfless service and it's not about you. Like I'll tell you, I didn't figure that shit. Excuse me. I didn't figure that out till I was like in my 30s. I think I always was a little, I think, you know, you talk to the people. The fun thing now is you can talk to the people you worked with when you were younger. And when you're a leader, you never know if they're being authentic, you know, genuine. You know, they probably want a 3-day pass or something if they're being nice to you. So, you know, I'm always hesitant to go like, oh, I'm a really good leader.
Oh, my
God. Like, no, they want something, right? Right. They want something. But now that you're older and you go back and you talk to people and you have a different relationship with the people that you work with, you know, that's one of the things that comes up. I think I was authentic and a selfless servant then. When my whole being took that in, when my heart, my mind became aligned with being selfless servant and being a servant leader, man, that was like rocket fuel, man. I don't know about you, but like that changed everything. And then number two is what you brought up, which is when you realize like, hey, this is how it is. Might as well just embrace it and channel that, to give me energy and positivity. It's a game changer. I wish my problem was, I just wish I would have known that when I was like 20, 21, you know? And I wasted like 10, 15 years trying to figure it out.
But who gets it in their 20s? I feel like nobody gets it in their 20s. You think you have it, but it's just not there.
That's the fuel that keeps you going.
Yeah.
And what happened to us, this is the only thing I can rationalize, is that, remember our generation? I mean, we were fed, like the movies we were fed, our toy from everything was just like, get big, fight, feed, breed, boom, boom, boom. And then we get into an opportunity where we go in there and we apply that. 2 wars, 20 years. You want to talk about road testing something? You made us into something you can't believe. The only way you temper something that was created like we were is you got to put death around it. old, the our elders act the way they do because of the amount of death that's around them all the time. You and I have seen more death at a young age, so it catapults us into that freaking bracket. You think like that. Mm-hmm. That's the only way I can think is because death's always around.
Huh. Yeah, and I mean, that was like, there's some sort of like poem or cliche.
You see all that white in your
that,
hair?
That was always...
you don't get that by accident. It's not
for
great.
For 20 years, that's death white. Just like lurked right there. It was always there. Man. I mean, I think I hadn't thought about that, man. You're like bringing up a lot of stuff. In my book, I talk about my uncles were all World War II vets. My dad was he was the niche generation, so he went to Korea, and they'd be like, "Yeah, Korea wasn't a real war," and they'd be all, you know, they weren't big. A couple of them were drinkers, but they weren't big drinkers. But every time we had like a family reunion, all the men would get together and they'd start busting each other's balls about, you know, like you were in the Navy, like Guadalcanal, you know, the Iron Bottom Sound, like whatever, kamikazes. I was a Marine. You know, that was like constant in my family.
All the time.
And then my dad was like the young one. And they're like, and Harvey, you're a war, Korea. That wasn't even a war. That was a police action. But, you know, you talk about like defining experiences, and I picked up on that too. And I know you did too, just around, like listening to those stories, and you're like, wow, man, these are real men here.
So yeah, I ran into one of our elders at a SEAL reunion from Bud's class one.
Oh, yeah.
Bumped into him by accident. I was fetching beers for somebody else, one of the other ones.
For
one of the chiefs. Because yeah. Age is rank. You can't get above it. You can't get behind it. And if you're younger, you're always a pussy. Excuse me. You know what I'm talking about. And he looked at me. He's like, you new meat piece of... He didn't care what I'd been through because it wasn't nothing. That's it. Look, we collect scars in this family, and you got to come down here and bleed. Mm-hmm. And we come down here to make the story, so when you and I get back up there, you better have something to tell. It's kind of like your key to get in the gate. So, I mean, think about that. And with our guys, it's nonstop. I mean, the story, when you sit around just listen to them jokers go to work, that's my favorite. Around a campfire, I don't care if you're a billionaire, astronaut, whatever, or the poorest son bitch on the planet, around a fire with your boys telling them stories is the best. We all gravitate towards that.
Okay, so I want to learn more about you. You were the Secretary of Defense under Trump, right?
Yeah, last 73 days, not a lot went on. Pretty quiet time.
But that's still an amazing title to be able to be given.
That's why they brought you in for that part.
What was that like, getting that?
You know, I joined the Army Reserve when I was 17, served. I was from Iowa City, Iowa, and a lot, I think, like Marcus, you know, you're raised by people of values and but it was all about, you know, looking forward. And so then I went I went Special Forces. But at the end of the day, I retired. I spent like 35, 36 years either as a government employee or as a military person. And then I got fixated. I was in this horrible job at the Pentagon. I was a civil servant, you know, I was like government employee. Because my wife wasn't going to move.
One knows about that's the biggest mystery down here is that sucker. It's like the pyramid over in Egypt.
Yeah, like what is a civil servant?
Like
what
no one knows what goes on in the Pentagon.
It's like when you go down to the Pentagon,
everyone
office.
Thinks CIA, Jason Bourne, right?
You know, it's like you are a government employee, like 4 million of us. Like when you go to the post office, you go to the Social Security office, and the person that handles your stuff, that's a government employee. I was just like a government employee, bureaucrat. You know, moving paper around versus a political appointee, which is like each administration gets to bring in like 2,000-3,000 people, and they're political appointees. They're not civil servants. Civil servant goes through all administrations. It's a job, right?
How many of those do we have? Do you know of like who that the CSs are?
I know in the Department of Defense there are a million civil servant civilian employees. Like, don't wear a uniform.
They're handling
supply transactions.
Check.
That, you know,
make it run
at Fort Bliss or whatever.
Right.
But how did you get to be a civil servant? So you were actually in the Army before that. Obviously, we went through that you were there for Red Wing. So how long did you actually serve as a soldier role?
joined the reserves at 17 and left as the Army. I retired in 2014. So I joined in 1983 as a reservist, weekend warrior type thing, went to college, retired from the Army after, I think I was 26, 27 years as an officer, retired in 2014. My wife had moved, we'd moved all over during our career. And my wife said, you know, we're not moving anymore. The kids were kind of that age where they were getting into high school. And my wife and I decided that we weren't going to move our kids around during their high school years. And, you know, the Army in its infinite wisdom is like, oh no, you're moving. So And so Marcus, I go to him, I'm like, hey, my one sole requirement was when my kid was a senior, I wanted to be there for their senior year. They didn't care. You know, they could care less. My kids were like, whatever. We don't even want to talk to you, Dad. But I wanted to be there for their senior year. So they wanted to send me overseas for one of my kids' senior year. And I went to my leadership and I just said, I'm begging you. I will. Next year, you can send me to Antarctica. I don't care. You can send me anywhere you want. They're like, hey, the way the Army works is you stand by to receive orders. And if you don't like them, you can quit. And I was like, Roger that. So I retired. But my wife wasn't going to move anymore. And I thought I could talk her out of it. She's like, you didn't hear me. I said, we're staying here. I was like, she goes, you can go wherever you want, but we're staying. We're staying here.
Let me rephrase that. Your ass can go anywhere you want.
That's what it was. Yeah. So if you're in DC, I retired out of Washington, DC, out of one of the special mission units, whatever, doesn't make any difference. And so if you're in DC, what are you going to do? It's a government town. Everybody's a government employee. So I got a job as a government contractor and then civilian. So I just became this person at the Pentagon that, you know, was a retired Army guy who changes into a suit and goes and does the same, you know, and just starts pushing paper. But And the thing is, when you're a government employee, you know, you can do another career and whatnot. But I shouldn't say that. I had issues with my boss. Go figure, Marcus. Like, oh, special operator having problems with his Air Force F-15
never heard
pilot
that.
Boss. that was a combo. My buddy was running counterterrorism for the president in what they call the National Security Council. The National Security Council does all the foreign policy and national security advising to the president and the vice president. It's located right next to the White House. So I always tell my kids, like, if you are asked to interview for a job, always interview, because Hunter, you listening? You guys back there listening? Always interview for the job, because one, and you're going to learn something and you might get the job. And then it's at the White House. So I'm like, yeah, I haven't been to the White House in like 30 years. So I go interview for the job and I start running counterterrorism. It's called for the National Security Council, where there's everybody in the government. Government's huge, right? So there are pieces and parts, you know, Department of Treasury, CIA, FBI, Homeland Security, Department of Defense, all these people have a role in counterterrorism. And I got fixated on this idea. Marcus, I got fixated. Go figure. Yeah. I did my net assessment and I had this thing against Al Qaeda. Like, it still burned that they attacked us in 2001.
Oh, you can't believe how that pissed some guys off.
Yeah.
And they Everybody. Were still out there in the field.
Yeah.
And it's kind of felt to me like the government had just kind of not moved on, but wasn't taking it as seriously.
And everyone knows how that works. I mean, that's part of it. And some of us are designed to make sure y'all freaking remember.
Yeah.
So I was like, I remember being in Afghanistan one time in, like, I think it was like 04, 05, and everybody had moved on. Everybody was focused on Iraq. Like, that's, and there were a bunch of us. I was the youngest, but there were some serious old timers, like really legendary figures that we can't talk about.
Yeah.
And they did this solemn oath. They're like, we will not quit. We will keep working until they're defeated. Well, we didn't think it was going to take 20 years. And then I'm the last one left. They'd all retired. They're all old men now and women. And I was the last one left. And I kind of took that oath pretty seriously. It seems silly, right? You know, and it was around a fire, Marcus, believe it or not.
Oh, sorry.
It was one of those things.
They're not funny. Those are serious. Like, when you make one of those, it means something.
Now, I took that. Like, you can call me stupid. You know, fine. I've been called worse. But I was like, no, I made a vow to see this one through. So I got in that position and I learned that Al Qaeda had been seriously, seriously weakened from all of our attacks against them over the years. We called it mowing the grass. Remember, Marcus? Yep. Like, just keep killing them off. Eventually there's, not going to be anybody left. And it worked. And I was surprised. So I just decided we got to stick with this. So I was in a position to, there were seven senior leaders in Al-Qaeda left. And I was like, so I'd ask all the young kids, hey, Marcus, remember, go to the intel sergeant who isn't going to like give you politically correct, like, oh, you know, on this hand or on this hand, they just tell you what they know. And I'd be like, hey, man, what happens if we kill Zawahiri had replaced bin Laden? So we're like, we got to get to this guy, bin Laden's replacement, and then we can declare the war over, right? Like, we kill this guy and all of his subordinates, we can say Al-Qaeda's defeated. Now, I get all this crap like, oh, you can't defeat terrorism. I was like, I know we can't defeat terrorism. That's a verb. We can defeat Al-Qaeda, noun, group. And defeat, I won't go bore everybody to tears, but you can defeat terrorist groups or armed groups, right? We all know this. So I just got fixated. I mean, I got obsessive.
Well, they're the ones you can.
Disorder.
They're the ones you can with. Countries and everything, you got to that means you have to kill everybody. With that, it's like anything else. We go in there and root them out. Dig their ass right out of there so fast. That what do you think we turn into? I mean, if we're fighting terrorists, we're trained terrorists. We're trained to cause terror to them. So much so that there won't be another group coming back up in there after them because of what we did to them.
Hey, Marcus, thanks
that
for saying
that.
That
was the mindset.
I could not pass my polygraph for the longest time because there was a question about, you know, do you support terrorism? Or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. And finally, the poor kid that was running, like, doesn't compute. Finally, I'm like, what the heck? I'm a special operator. We basically.
That's my job.
You know, and they're like, what? And their eyes go different directions. And finally, they brought in an old timer's like, don't ask that question to him anymore.
Yeah.
So I got really fixated on that. And then, special operator, right? I'm talking way too much. Operator, like, what do you do, Mark? Is figure out the network, figure out the incentive system, communicate, execute. So that's kind of my little rubric that I use. And I realized the only person that could get us to keep attacking was President Trump. So my buddy was close to President Trump. I wasn't close to President Trump. So I used a surrogate, right? I was like, the only person that could tell the CIA, the Department of Defense, everybody that the priority is not, China or whatever. It's we're going to end this war by killing these people off. So my buddy, so he would go to the president, like, hey, boss, this is where we are. And I just execute, right? So we just became fixated. And then we killed off this head of ISIS, right? This guy was the most evil dude. And I'm not into good and evil typically when you're fighting your enemy. Because you want to keep a little distance, emotional distance. But this guy was the definition of evil. Like, the things he did to people is beyond comprehension. So we killed that guy. Our counterterrorism forces killed this guy one night. And that's where I met the president face to face, because he was in the situation room, part of the operation. And at that point, I think the president kind of identified this Miller guy, this guy with the white hair, kind of, tall, dorky, geeky, like he can get stuff done. And then I got a point. So you asked the question, like, what's the difference between a civil servant and the military? So I was just like a government employee, nothing special, just doing my job like they all do. And then the president asked me if I wanted to become a political appointee. So it just goes on from there. And then just by a bunch of luck, weird circumstances, I ended up for the final bit working for at the Pentagon, running the Pentagon. Well, I'll just real quick, like, the president was right. He goes, we have what's the biggest threat against our country? And it was like, at the time, 77,000 Americans were dying each year from illicit drugs flowing up from the border, right? I mean, like that's a lot of people, And now it's 110, 120. President's like, we need to stop that. What's the military doing? And the military is like, we're focused on China. We're focused on China. And I was like, no, we need to focus on the thing that's killing Americans. And we need to secure our border. And we need to actually go out and hunt them down, wherever the drug labs are. and wherever the doggone drug cartels are. And we need to get really, really aggressive because they're killing our people. And so the president and I were in alignment on that. He thought I could probably help out a little bit with that.
That's awesome. What did you... What was your involvement with that? Because that's still, like you said, I mean, the numbers have gone up since then. Do you feel like there was any headway made?
No. The Borg of our United States government, based on, you know, it's huge, it's lethargic, it's bureaucratic. And, you know, it became such a politicized issue that President Trump was seen as like, you know, you guys are living down at the border. You know what I'm talking about. That build the wall, and they just turned it into all this crazy nonsense political stuff. But his point was, we need to secure our border from illicit flows, whether it's human beings or whether it's narcotics or illegal goods and whatnot. And a lot of the people at the Pentagon, I could just speak for the Pentagon, Homeland Security would try, but there was a lot of resistance because they feel like it's a zero sum game. If we, like, heaven for, I'll give you an example, silly radar. Just a radar that could be used to look into the Caribbean to see the planes that are flying through. There was a gap in our coverage because one of them had broken. So we need the commander down there and the people said, hey, we need a new radar. But to do that, now we spend, you know, $800 billion a year on defense. You think we could find a stupid radar, right? You would have thought it was the end of the world. So because we needed to pull a radar from the Pacific to bring it in. And of course, the people in the Pacific were, if you take our radar, you know, the United States is at risk. So we just kept dealing with all this stuff. And there was never that, the whole Pentagon as a whole never came to agree that we needed to use military force on our border. And I don't know, what do you guys think? Because I think that's, you know, the purpose of the military is the not only protect and serve, but defend the Constitution, but, you know, ultimately, to protect the citizens in the United States. And I thought that was a pretty good use, but there's a lot of pushback for all these reasons that I could go on for the next 3 hours. And you're like, dude, stop talking because this show is not about that.
Well, I feel like with everything that's going on today, there's legitimate concern with China, but there's also huge concern with our border. And we live close enough to it. And my cousin, which is my best friend, her husband is a Border Patrol agent. So we hear firsthand stories of this weekly, and it is a huge concern that no one pays attention to. No one ever thinks about the stuff that's actually happening at the border. Marcus and I were actually, we were able to go down there and visit a lot of the different Border Patrol stations down there. We even got to go on a boat on the river and see what was going on. And it is insane. It's insane. It's illegal. And they keep saying like this illegal activity is going on. Then why not do something about it? Why not utilize our military to do something about it? But a lot of people think that it's just about asylum seekers coming over. That's not it at all.
See, you saw it. You saw it with your own eyes. Yeah. And I don't mean to give some like national security seminar, but I'll just be really, really quick. You, the American taxpayers, we pay a ton of money, $800 billion plus. That's like 60%+ of what's available to spend the federal government does for defense. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can do two things.
Yeah.
We can handle China. We can do more than two things. We can do three things. We can do China, we can handle Russia, and we can also handle our border. But you hear the generals and the senior civilians like, oh my gosh, we have to only focus on one thing. No, that's not what our military does. We can do more than one thing. And it bothers me that we have this idea now that the military can only do one thing. Like, we can only focus on one thing. No, actually, the military can do a lot of things. We fought a world war. You know, I think we can probably do more than one thing. Yeah. So I don't know. What do you think, Marcus? I'm just like, you
well,
triggered
usually
me.
If
I'm
you got somebody that's really good
it's,
at one thing.
It's like, come on.
You just got a leader that's good at one thing, and they'll always show you what they're good at. But there's many departments in the United States. If I told you that I was like, hey, some strange dude is going to show up to your house with some random freaking kid to go in there and do God knows what, would you let that happen? I mean, if I told you two dudes were going to sneak over your wall with a kid that's not theirs, what are you going to do? You're going to give them a bus ride up to a hotel? When I say it out loud like that, it ought to bother you.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's happening down here.
And we saw, Marcus and I actually got to see it.
If you got people who aren't in charge, you're trying to be friendly with everybody, man, you can't do that. Because if everybody gets their way, there is no way.
Yeah, there were men in their 20s and 30s with children that did not belong to them, sitting on their laps, waiting to be checked in and released into
with
America.
With some random kid.
Yeah.
Like, you just let some dude walk in with some random kid.
That's
to do
not
what
okay.
with him? What are you going to do with him?
And
he's like, oh, well, they said they was going to show back up with the kid?
Yeah.
I mean, if you didn't get their name in the beginning, which we all know, it's horse shit.
Yeah. It is a terrible situation that's going on.
Hey, man, you reap what you sow. Mm-hmm. If you put leaders in like that, I don't want to hear you complain.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how we learn. Do y'all understand that? This is how we learn, man. If you have to sit back and watch it go down. I can't do anything about it.
I just didn't think it was that complicated. I kind of understood what the president was trying to do. And then, you know, the other thing was, it's like, hey, let's wind down these wars, these wars. And, you know, I did my survey group of all veterans serving members. And because I was like, hey, what do you think about drawing down in Afghanistan? Every one of them was like, we got to do this, man. We gave it a good shot. Now, remember, this wasn't going to zero like the Biden administration did. There was a plan for a deliberate drawdown and then have a stay behind presence, special operators and intelligence professionals that could keep. Remember, we took the country down with 200 people. I was like, we can hold this thing together and buy them enough time to get some sort of agreement. So that was the idea. That was the other thing the president asked. I was like, all in. And all my buddies were like, yeah, it's time. Let's go ahead. Because, you know, you always worry about, we've all experienced loss there. And you always think about the families of those that, gave their treasure to this country, you know? So you wanted to be very, very mature and very, very thoughtful about that. And I talked to families too. I said, they were like, yeah, it's probably time to start winding this thing down. We gave it our best shot. Let's go ahead and transition to something else. Not like surrender like we did, but we had a different plan. That was the other thing. And then what I really wanted, we took special operations. The forces that fought this war weren't getting recognized enough bureaucratically, so we helped elevate them. But here's the real one, that at the end of the day, what we wanted to do was support members of the armed forces, veterans, and their families that weren't being heard. And I can give you a bunch of examples where you know, you go down there. My big thing was to go out in the field, go overseas, listen to soldiers or listen to people in our armed forces, listen to families. And, you know, so many of their things, I'll give you a real quick story. We're in Bahrain doing Thanksgiving. You know, Marcus, how, you know, you always have to go out on Thanksgiving and serve meals to the troops. We did that like four places in 24 hours. It was a lot of work, but I was glad to do it. We just kind of hopscotched all over the Middle East and Africa, served and talked to people. There's this kid and having a meal with him. This kid, young guy, probably 19. He was the admin guy. He was a Navy guy, Marcus. He was in Bahrain, and his job was to make ID cards for family members. That was his job.
Yeah.
You know, and he,
how about that?
And I said,
how
yeah,
about
I said,
that?
Hey, and he was kind of one of these like interesting kids, you know. And I said, hey, what's if you were in my position, what would you do? And he goes, I would get his ID card machine was not working because it was missing like a part. And he goes, I can't do my job because we're missing the part for the ID card machine. And if I was you, I'd get me the part for the ID card machine so I can do my job and help families. Dude, I was literally like, excuse me? And it was so fun. You know, I turned over my shoulder because when you're the Secretary of Defense, you got like thousands of bag carriers, right?
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, sir,
it's
here's
something.
Your Diet
yeah,
Coke.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, here's your Diet Coke exactly at 32.4 degrees. You know? I'm like, oh, this is 32.6 degrees. I wasn't that way, obviously, but it was so fun. At that point, you just turn over your shoulder. You call up the Marine Lieutenant Colonel who's helping you out. You're like, get the guy the part. So the next day, the part shows up, you know. But to be out there, my point was for that period, Once we got did the drawdown, once we did special operations elevation, it was all about just helping out people. And I could go on all day about that, but that was like the power of that. And I felt like, well, Marcus, there was this kid, Jim Moriarty, they're from Texas.
Yeah.
Sar Moriarty was killed in Jordan, during the, he was an Army Green Beret from the Special Forces group. It wasn't Jim Moriarty. It was Sergeant Moriarty. Excuse me. His dad's Jim. Sar Moriarty was killed it wasn't friendly fire incident. They were going through, they were coming back from the field. They were going through a checkpoint and a Jordanian started shooting at him. They have it all on video. Moriarty like deserves the Medal of Honor. As a matter of fact, his commander put him in for the Medal of Honor. But due to political sensitivities, like they gave him, I think, a Bronze Star for valor. He's dead, right? Obviously. So my buddy, who was the commander at the time, goes, you know, he got screwed. So when I became the acting Secretary of Defense, I was like, we're gonna take care of things that have gone wrong. And that was one of the things we were able to do, was to elevate, to resubmit his paperwork. And his family was presented a Silver Star. And, you know, was that kind of stuff where, you know, that's what we wanted to do, was to make sure we recognized the people that were getting worked over and the system wasn't working for. You know, they always talk about mission first, people always, but that's not always the case. So that was our big thing, was like, let's try to help make people's lives a little bit easier, or to provide some solace to those that have lost their loved ones. So that's a long answer. That's what we did. You know, you can argue whether we did a good job or a bad job, but tried to help out.
And it took me forever to remember that the civilian operator or civilian contractors, they're kind of taught to speak military. They're taught to speak our language. But like with us, when you threw us into the wars, we started speaking in slang. Like our military went to slang, and then it got hammered in there. And then each unit you were with, if you operated with them, you learned how to talk to them. So it was as somebody be reading a write up for somebody, and they'd be like, oh, they don't deserve that. I'm like, whoa, hold on. What was that dude's job? And where was he at when he got in that? Because if he didn't belong in there and got into something, that's completely different. But it's so dynamic. Just take your regular family that you live with and go throw them into a war zone. Imagine what that's like. And then you're going to see who does what. And there's a lot of comedy in that. There is. But then there's the stuff that gets overlooked because it's so dynamic. You got to go so fast with it.
Well, you did a good job.
Yeah, hell yeah, man. You had a great one.
So in your book, what else do you, just to be able to promote your book a little bit, what else do you talk about in there? Is it all just what happened while you were Secretary of Defense?
No, it's much more. That's only a small part of it. I only did it for 73 days. It's really about my experiences, because we were talking about someday hopefully doing a lessons learned. I had a buddy of mine goes, don't write. Well, first off, I come out of government absolutely broke. Actually, I was like $25,000 in debt. I had no job, because when you're a political appointee versus we were talking about a government employees just keep working regardless of who's in charge of the government. It's a political appointee at 12:01 on the 20th of January, 2021. I'm out of work and I'm not independently wealthy. Like a lot of these cabinet secretaries, these bigwigs, you know, they all have their jobs, and I didn't have anything. So I had to start over. I literally had to start over. Well, I was in the hole already, you know. So we're trying to take care of our families over the years. So I had no work. So somebody goes, you should write a book. I'm like, I don't want to write a book. But then they offered, you know, had an opportunity to write a book, and they gave an advance. I was like, oh, this, do you get paid for this crap? Okay. So I now had some time. So how am I going to write this book, and what's it about? And what I decided was, my buddy goes, hey man, don't just tell us how good you are. Like all these memoirs of the bigwigs that have been in DC and the generals and all this, like, you know, their poop never stinks. You know, it's all, there's just, everything's great. He goes, tell us all the stuff you did wrong. And I'm like, that was always my thing, was like, you don't learn from when you are successful at something. I can't speak for you guys, but I only learn when I screw something up. So I tried to use vignettes from my military career coming up where I did things wrong and how it developed me as a person. So the book really, I had a real revelation after January 6th and all the crazy things that people said about our military. And I was like, I've been suspecting for a long, long time that, remember, only 7% of Americans are veterans. 1% are currently serving. You guys know this, like the back of your hand. versus, say, coming out of World War II, right? We're like 50%,
huge.
And everybody knew how the military worked. And fortunately, we're at a place now where we don't have to have everybody serve. I think it's a good problem to have, right? Like, we're not at war right now, so we don't have to have this. Everybody has to serve. I think we could talk about that, about national service.
Oh, sure. That's a whole, well, yeah, because then eventually what happens is, you know, the separation between the, yeah.
You got it. So I was seeing that, Marcus, and the stuff that we know, like, why did that happen? You and I are like, because that's the way the military works, because Sergeant Jones misinterprets a conversation or his orders and turns right instead of turn left. That's just how the military works.
That's how it works.
And I realized that the American people had kind of grown distant and weren't familiar with their military. By the same time, the military was getting much more like sanctioned off and kind of in a gated community, and they were getting separated. So what I wanted to do with the book was try to bring the two together. I know this sounds insane, like,
no, that's right,
why you, but what I wanted to do was try to like educate both sides so we better understand each other, because at the end of the day, spend a lot of money in the military. The military is the only thing that really can threaten our republic, and that's a problem, and we need to communicate better. So I wanted to do that. And then finally, I was really, really, really pissed about the way Afghanistan ended. And I'm concerned that like senior leaders aren't being held accountable. Like Marcus, I had a buddy who messed up a supply piece of paperwork. We kicked him out of Special Forces.
Oh,
we didn't. Hey. I didn't. And I'm like, so we will fire a kid who messes up a piece of paperwork, and our generals and our senior civilian leaders in national security aren't held accountable for losing a war. And so I'm all about accountability. I was born that way. I was raised that way in the military. You take responsibility for everything that does or doesn't happen. And I just can't get beyond the hypocrisy of a lot of these people who are all now, you know, and making tons of money as talking heads and all this. I'm like, do any other business where you fail, you lose your job, but these people still continue to, you know, profit from their failed decisions. And so I'm angry, and I hope it doesn't come across in the book, because you don't want to be petty, but that's what the book's about, those three things.
Do you mind telling us your experience with January 6th?
Oh yeah, happy to. I'll be simple. Like the cops said they had it. We did a whole bunch of meetings and a lot of coordination and synchronization meetings. The cops are like, hey, we got this. We usually, they put 10,000 police on the street that day. They said typically that we can handle up to 1 million demonstrators with 10,000 police. The military, here's the thing, military is not, should never do civilian law enforcement.
That's a rule. Mm-hmm. That's a rule.
What?
That's a rule. Right? That might be
that's
a law, that's, I think. Yeah, you can't put the boys in uniform. You can't stand us against their people. That's an absolute.
Only with martial law, you know, yeah. and it's like, I'm like, we don't need to do that. Right. So I asked everybody, what do you need us to provide? There's a way to do it where you can provide military support. The mayor of Washington, D.C. asked for 250 people, quick reaction force. And we're like, you got it. You need anything else? Nope. We don't need anything else. Cops can handle it. And then it goes down and, you know, they gave it a good shot, the police, but got overrun. And, you know, we got going with the National Guard. But here's the thing, Marcus, you know how deployment sequence works. You just don't snap your fingers and like all of a sudden people show up.
Oh, I got
it. And that's, so I try to tell about that in the book. Like, this is how the military works. Like, this isn't Halo. You know, my son loves playing Halo. By the way, I've only played Halo once, Marcus, and it was in Assadabad against Navy SEALs. And they had their little team room, and we had our team room, and we had it wired.
Yeah, of course.
So we used
government,
like T1 cable.
It was great.
So it was, and you guys just absolutely destroyed me.
Well, we invented the game.
It was embarrassing.
It's hard for y'all to have a chance when we're the ones that invented it.
So that's funny.
Yeah, you just embarrassed me. It was like great. I didn't know how to move, so I ended up in a corner with my head going,
how about
Master
that? Remember
Chief,
that? Stuck boom, in the boom, deal boom. There?
And the Navy SEALs would come up behind me, you know, virtually and like shoot me in the back of the head. It was so much fun.
Well, I was better standing in that damn corner your whole life.
But it's, you know, it's not a video game, right? You know, it takes a while. You got to get your people prepared to go out to fight. And so all the, I finally read the 1-6 report, and then we did an inspector general report about our response because I knew we were going to get studied. And every, finally, after all the politics, Nancy Pelosi pushed the Department of Defense under the bus in the 7th. I could go on all day. Obviously, you triggered my emotions, but yeah, that's in the book. And I try to explain, like, this is how your military works domestically in the United States. So try to explain a little bit there. I'll sell like 2 copies. Nobody will care, but that's not the point.
To put people at ease, the way it was explained to me, I remember watching the news when they had all the National Guard in uniform, the Humvees were up at the Capitol and everything, and they were all upset that the National Guard and the Army was... I was like, well, man, that's actually our most wonderful people. They're the ones that serve. That's actually their town. They just identified themselves by throwing their uniforms on. That's it. And then when it's over, they go back to doing their deal. What most people think when they think martial law is that if someone other country comes in to try and impose law on us, that doesn't work here. You wouldn't be able to do that. I mean, when Americans get pissed, especially at each other, we kill each other more than anybody. That's right. The one thing we got. I mean, that's a cold, hard fact.
That's true. That's exactly right. Now, that's the other thing where we kind of get ahistoric. And I don't like to give history lessons because it's pedantic and everybody rolls their eyes. And like my kids are like, oh, here goes dad again. So I'm not going to do that. But you just hit the nail on the head. Like it's the real deal. And you don't put your military out in the street to fight fellow Americans unless everything has gone south. Because, and that means like the cops are completely, everybody's like, well, Chris, if the Capitol Hill was overrun that day. And I'm like, yeah, but there were still 9,000 cops available that could have moved there. So at the end of the day, man, it's just super bad to have the military doing anything domestic law enforcement. If there's a natural disaster, that's a different thing. Like, you know, when
that's
you guys
completely different.
That's completely
different.
We're talking
people's
about two
tones
different
are
things.
Different. Yeah, you're talking. Well, that's right. Yeah. And when you're living in a divorced house like we are now, like most everything they argue about is a divorced mom and dad picking at each other. One of them screws up. The other one looks at him and makes fun. I watched it when I was up there the other day when my brother got elected.
Yeah, we were sitting
and that's
there.
How I try to describe it. Mel and I were like, hey, man, this is like a divorced house. And like they literally bicker like a married couple that live in
that's
a
exactly
house together.
It. Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
That
you
hate each other.
That hate each other now.
But have to work together. Because
right. So when
got
the kids,
kids
when the kids bitch outside, one of them gives them a bunch of money to shut up. And then the other one straps the rules on them. That's what we're dealing with right now. And there's a transition of power to us. This next generation's coming in and the baby boomers, they're kind of, I get it. It's all part of the process.
I talk about Marcus. Holy cow.
It's all part of the process.
It's so
good.
Great.
Just,
great
you gotta calm down.
Sometimes I feel alone when I say these things, that we're in the midst of a generational transformation and our generation is going to pick this up. And I've got to tell you, I am so excited and proud of our younger generations. Like everybody wants to like criticize them, like, oh, they're on their cell phone all the time. They are so smart. This country's in good shape.
Remember what they said about us?
I refuse to get all down and like, the best days are behind us. No, these kids coming up behind us. But hey, Marcus, we got to be the bridging generation.
Well,
we
are.
Got
we're the center of the
hourglass.
We always
got the crappy jobs.
Yeah.
We always got the crappy jobs. We're not going to get any credit. And that's all right, because that's not why we do this business. And that's why it's important. What you're doing is to continue to serve and continue to educate. But we got to be the bridging generation that gets through the craziness of the baby boomers and all their selfishness and hand it off to the next generation. These kids are so they are so motivated and want to serve and believe in the best of people. Of course, our generation is like, don't do that. You're going to get, shafted. But the positivity. Do you see that?
Absolutely. When you say we have to bridge the gap, man, hey, when we grew up, we went at a high school, college, went to the mall. Okay. Hip hop became big. Like every one of us from black, every color flooded together. It was all great. Tech was about to come online. This whole America was about to come a paradise. Then we get punched in the face during 9/11 and they jerk our ass, the whole generation, and throw us back to Babylon. While everybody else around here got to play with the new toys and stuff we didn't get. And think about what it turned us into. We didn't have a choice. I mean, we got trained and raised up in our adult, from kids to adult, over there in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's where we were raised. So you have an entire generation of foreigners that were born here, like us. That's we got perfect. Sharpened over there. And now that we're back, the younger generation, we can see the talent inside of them. It's all there. But the transition is everyone's kind of like free. I'm like, hey, man, just tell me all right. Yeah, our generation's crazy. We had to be. But right. We'll get it done. Look what we did. Normally back in the day, they would have sent the entire country to go after bin Laden. Entire country. The army, everybody. We sent a handful of guys. We're different. We're molded different. It's all right. I mean, most all of ours are still sleeping. They just got done with 20 years of war, so they're drinking and watching TV and, you know, whatever else.
Yeah.
I say PTSD is pissed off, tired, stoned, and drunk, right? They're either one of those. It's just we went through a lot. We got back, and then everyone got sick. So 20 years of war, then we got sick, and then now we're here. We'll be fine. Don't worry about it.
Hey, Marcus, you don't get battle weakened. I know you're really, really involved with this. And like the Marr brothers, and what I'm seeing, what I love about our generation of veterans is we're not relying on, I think I got to tell you, the government's trying, but we're not relying on like large institutions. It's like, that's the story of our generation is we're going to do it organically. We're going to do it together. And you're a leader of this, whether you like it or not. And the Marr brothers and what people are doing with alternative medical therapies. And I think it's just amazing.
That is.
And you guys are in the lead down there in Texas right now. Thank you for, and I know you're part of that because I'm like, if anything can provide solace and help and assistance, why wouldn't we do it? Like, I don't give a crap.
We can. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's like, man, every time I hear somebody say we can't get that done, like, especially in the country, like last generations, well, that thing's meaning to be repaired for 100 years. Why didn't it get repaired right now? The Americans can do anything. Yeah. And I mean quickly. It just blows me. There's no problems. We create our own problems.
Well, and what you're talking about, it's actually a true healing. It's not a pill bottle that's going to just have some temporary relief of something. Like when I met Marcus, the VA was sending him like a Costco-sized bottle of Vicodin in the mail.
It was awesome.
And I hated it.
I had a great time. Everyone else hated me. I had a wonderful time.
As
being
his
hurt,
wife, man, like, it was awful. It was so awful. I'm not even going to go there. It was just terrible. And we dealt with that off and on, I mean, for 10 years of our marriage and then off and on. But when we found this alternative medicine, which personally I would have never endorsed because I'm like, I just don't like anything that would be considered a drug.
You're just like my wife.
I'm super against, but I saw what it did.
To see those young, they are young veterans or yeah. veterans that are taking care of each other and pushing this forward because we're, and, you know, that's what I just love. It's like, hey, I love the VFW. I love the American Legion. Nothing against them. They do great work. But, you know, this is like a startup economy with all these veterans coming out. And they're like,
can you believe that?
And they hacked the system.
They did.
They're like, hey, do you realize that there are these therapies that are available? And what I love, it's all clinically, you know, used. So I just think.
So what happened to us, man? Did so many of us get broke? Our entire generation got broke together that we were just in hell going, now what do y'all want to do? Climb back out?
I asked.
I mean, because the guys and girls are amazing.
But you brought it up. I mean, the same fighting formation, special operations, fought this war, and it's all right. You know, it's not like, oh, woe is us. But I don't think we have any data on using the same people to fight 20 years of war. I don't think there's no data. Nah. So, you know, there's all the therapies that might have worked in the past. We don't know how this is going to affect. I told you, Marcus, last night I was out there watching the new guys do a validation exercise, special forces. And, you know, my back started hurting as they were carrying casualties and, you know, all that stuff. You know, if you're just in for 4 years, you can handle that, right? Like, you know, I tweak my back. When you do that crap for 25, 30 years, you know, picking up casualties again and again, you know, we don't even know how that affects the human body, yeah. much less the human brain. So that's yeah. why probably overshare, but that's why I think it's just so important what you and other people are doing at the kind of grassroots organic level to provide support.
Oh, we road test everything on ourselves before we'd even. It's like, and hey, it man, works. Talk cheap. Get out there. And it's like, hey, if you see that sucker is doing better, you can just see it. Mm-hmm. Too much talking. Get your ass out there and start doing that living, right? And let's see what's what.
It actually works. And like I said, I would be the last person in the world to endorse it, but I do endorse it because I have seen it work. I know that it's an actual healer. It's not just a it's not a temporary fix. It's
right.
It is actually healing. So I'm a full advocate for.
All right, brother. We kept you on here for 2 hours, man. Leave us with something. Through all this, words of wisdom.
Through all this, what was your, like, give us some never quit tidbits.
Well, I've got no words of wisdom. I'm just like insanely over the top honored to, you know, serve in some small way our great country. But yeah, you bring up never quit, and I love your theme, and I love what you're doing. And, you know, my wife. Oh, I had a good one the other day. My sister asked, you know, why did you do all that stupid stuff? And I'm like, well, because I was raised to serve, and you serve at the pleasure of the president. When your boss asks you to do something, I was raised that you go ahead and answer the call of duty. And then just when times are tough, just because things get tough and, you know, Marcus, you had a whole different experience with like deep down physical, tough, moral, ethical, mental, tough, in DC, it's not any of that. It's probably moral courage more than anything. And when times are tough, you don't quit, you know, it's easy to quit. And I do tell my children, like, I got this question the other day, like, I got a great question the other day. It was like, they probably stole it off the internet, but it was a college kid. I was doing a talk and they asked like, hey, what advice would you give your younger self? And I said, I would have quit more often because I can't quit. I was just raised that way.
Isn't that funny? I think
I know you are too.
That out too. So I was like, oh, if I could do all this shit, I'd quit everything and be able to sit on the couch. Yeah, right? I was like.
I tell my kids, like, it's all right to quit because it wasn't all right to quit in my generation. For my parents, like you don't quit. Like, you signed up. You said you're going to do this. You're going to finish out your obligation. And then if you don't want to return, that's all right. You're not allowed to quit.
Yeah.
And so my takeaway from my experiences as the acting Secretary of Defense, where times get tough, they talk about, Thomas Paine talks about sunshine patriots. It's like, we don't quit. Like, you take the job, you see it through to the end. And I'll tell you what, it takes, you know, it's going to hurt your reputation. You know, your family's going to be damaged by it. But we also have faith because my wife's such an incredibly strong woman like you that she would take care. I knew she could take care of the family. I knew we'd be all right because we had a foundation, but it's like, everybody's like, why didn't you quit after January 6th? I was like, why would I quit? I mean, and it's not like because I was the only one who could do the job. The military, Marcus, you know, next man up, no offense. It's like, hey, that's the way we're raised. I knew if I would have left, somebody would have come in behind me, but that's not what we do. You see it through to the end. You don't quit. So that's not words of wisdom.
The big thing that's scratched in the concrete above a house is "In God We Trust." Mm-hmm. Your ass gets stuck in a certain spot at a certain time for a certain reason.
Yeah.
And when someone's like, "Man, I can't believe you went through this," it's like, who you want to go through it? Who did you want in this spot? This is the one I had to take. I didn't even have to. I just that I got appointed to. Same with you. You just kind of get moved into those positions because you were the one that could take it. And I'll just sit here and do this till you find somebody better. Matter of fact, when people come at me, I'm like, hey, man, I know you could have done a better job than me. I kill them with kindness. I'm like, I know you're better than me. You're so smart. I like that. I barely got through it, but I learned a lot of stuff, though, because every time I get my ass whipped, that's why I went in there. The most valuable lessons you pull are out of them kind of whippings. Because next time it goes down, people are going to be like, where's Chris at? That's some gun. He went through some shit.
Bring there, Chris back.
Hey, what do you think? What do you think? Because not only that, you have to analyze everything. You got to go back and be like, and then there's just life. But people are always going to want to answer. John and I were talking. What's the hardest one to answer? The why. Everyone's is different.
Yeah, I love that question. I just actually started hearing that one recently. In the last couple months, like, what's the why? Yeah, it's really powerful. And I got to tell you, you know, my sister asked me that question and I was at home, parents getting old, trying to help out. My sister said, why did you do all this? And I had never thought about it. I was like deer in a headlight. I was like, I've never thought about the why. Finally, I'm like, because we serve. That's what our family does.
Because it was
we
cool. Serve. That's what I say. Yeah. I mean, because in the beginning, that's what it was. Because it was cool.
I feel like such a moron. You know, I was like, I thought I would have some like, you know, well, it reminds me of Thucydides and, you know, blah, blah. I had nothing. I was like, because that's what we do. We just serve and we don't quit, you know, and that's that greatest strength, your greatest weakness. Right. You know, that's why I tell my kids, like, it's all right to quit sometimes.
Yeah.
Great conversation. Thanks.
You bet, brother. I appreciate you, man.
Yeah. So yeah. Thanks a lot for doing this. Same, and all the best. If there's anything I could do to be of service to you guys ever, thanks for, and I'm serious. Thanks for what you're doing with, you got a crew down there of a lot of people. It's really neat to see your network. And I kind of am on the fringes with a lot of things. So it's really cool what you guys are doing. And thanks. It is a calling. And I think this is what we do for the next phase of our life until somebody decides something different.
That's right. All right, brother. God bless you, man.
How can people find you? Like, how can people get the book and everything?
Soldier Secretary. I forgot that I should. I'm traveling right now and I gave one of my books away. I should now pull up the thing. I don't do LinkedIn. And I need to do that, but I was, you know, I came up in a community where you didn't do that. And so I still don't do it, but So Soldier Secretary by Chris Miller, had a great co-writer who's down in Austin, by the way. Hey, if you can, what's his face? I'm honored to do your podcast as the coming out party. But what's that one guy, Rogan? Rogan a call. Tell him he needs to bring me on sometime too.
Thank you.
I'm sure Rogan, like, I know he gets these military officers on and they're all like, wah, 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 wah. Yeah. And I'm sure Rogan's like, oh man, I can't do another one of these dudes who just like gives me the party lines and talking points.
Yeah, but, he's more of an SF guy. Man,
you brought it up. We're all stuck in like 2003 right now. So you give him a call and say, Miller's not a complete, you know, stick up his butt kind of guy.
That's exactly how I'd say it.
All right. So yeah, book is out. It drops February 7th. You can pre-order now. And so I'm learning more about this publishing thing. And Marcus, we're all competitive, even though we act like we're not, because we're special operators, right? We are like, oh, it's all good. Never let them see a sweat, but we are hyper competitive.
Yeah.
And I really, really, really want, for no other reason than just to, you know, show the liberal media that we still have a voice out there. And I'd really like to get on the New York Times, go into the belly of the beast and get on the New York Times bestseller list somewhere on there. So it all comes down to pre-order sales, first week sales. So
yeah, we're going to do what we can to push you out there, brother.
And I'm making no money on this, and whatever I make, I'll keep some of it. Don't get me wrong, but I plan to cycle in. I do. I'm on three nonprofits. One's for veteran suicide. One's Daniel Elkins from Special Operations Association of America, trying to help out veterans and families and those still serving. And then I'm in this last one. I forgot the name of it, but it's a special operations one. So I plan to like try to take as much resources as I earn off this. If I make any money, I don't think I'm going to make any money on the book, to tell you the truth, you know, to cycle it back into the brotherhood and sisterhood.
Awesome. Right on, brother. Thank you for your service. You've got an incredible career and just your story is great. Thank you.
We're just getting started. We'll thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
And thank you everybody for listening in. We appreciate each and every one of you. Don't forget to like and subscribe. We'll see you next week.